Dozens of 13 and 14-year-old children have been sentenced to life imprisonment with no possibility of parole in this nation. That's the topic of our next story. In a new report called Cruel and Unusual, the Equal Justice Initiative has documented 73 such cases. The United States is the only country in the world where a 13-year-old is known to be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In fact, over 2,225 juveniles, aged 17 or younger, have been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole in the U.S. The children documented in this report are overwhelmingly poor, lacked legal representation, and are majority children of color. In fact, every single one of the children condemned to death in prison for non-homicide offenses are children of color. The United States Supreme Court recently declared that death by execution is unconstitutional for juveniles, but life imprisonment without parole for children has yet to be overturned. According to the Equal Justice Coalition, sentencing young children to imprisonment until death violates international law and the U.S. Constitution. My guest is Brian Stevenson. He is the executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, which is based in Montgomery, Alabama. He's also a professor of law at the New York University School of Law. Welcome to Uprising, Brian.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thanks very much for joining us today. I have to say, when I read this report and when I looked at the photographs in it, in the report, it made me cry. And, you know, I'm not afraid of saying that on the air. It was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Absolutely heartbreaking that there are these young children. Tell our listeners a little bit about these 74 cases that you documented and some of the main reasons why these children have been sentenced to life in prison.
Well, you know, they are really tragic cases, and working with this community of kids can absolutely overwhelm you because it's just so painful to see young kids who through most of their lives have been abandoned, neglected, abused, really trying to survive very difficult and violent home lives, get caught up in the criminal justice system and then essentially be condemned to death in prison for crimes at 13 and 14. Most of these are kids were obviously poor kids, kids of color who did not have access to good legal help, and that's why the results in some of these cases are so extreme. As you indicated, there are several of these children who have been condemned to life imprisonment without parole for non-homicide offenses. We have a case in California involving a young man, 14-year-old Antonio Nunez, who was convicted of an aggravated kidnapping where no one was injured. It was an older man who involved him in this crime. They were tried in a joint trial. He's now been in prison for 7 years, but he's been sentenced to death in prison. We've got cases in Florida involving crimes where there were no homicides. And all of these cases really reveal the problems of mass incarceration and an overly aggressive criminal justice system. Most of the kids got very poor representation. One of our clients, Ian Manuel, was actually told to plead guilty to aggravated assault, which he did, and then the judge sentenced him to death in prison. And, of course, he would never plead guilty to the maximum sentence, but his lawyer didn't advise him of that. None of the kids that we have been working with had legal representation when we started this project 2 years ago, and many of them are now procedurally precluded from challenging their convictions and sentences.
Why is that?
Well, in 1996, the Congress passed a law called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which greatly restricts post-conviction challenges in this country. It was the first major restriction on habeas corpus in our country's history. One of the provisions created a one-year statute of limitation for challenging a wrongful conviction, and that provision has now blocked review of convictions and sentences for thousands of prisoners. And so many of these kids couldn't get the legal help they needed before their statute of limitation expired. We filed appeals for many of these kids, but we're going to have a hard time overcoming some of these procedural obstacles, and that's going to be the bulk of the challenge. But it's been really energizing for a lot of the kids to finally have someone engaging with them and advocating for them. We do believe that this punishment constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment. As you indicated, the U.S. is the only country in the world where children this young have been condemned to death in prison. These sentences are illegal under international law. International treaties and norms have expressly prohibited life without parole for young juveniles. So we're going to do what we can to create some hope for these kids and hopefully overturn these sentences.
Well, how does the U.S. compare to other countries or even just the entire rest of the world in imprisoning children who committed crimes at such a young age?
Well, we've entered a stage in this country's history where incarceration has become such a primary focus that you know, it has caught up a lot of kids. As I'm sure you well know, we now incarcerate more people than any other country in the world. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. And what that has meant for young people is that as states have lowered the minimum age for trying kids as adults, which many states did in the 1990s, the rate of juvenile incarceration has also increased. What's frustrating about a lot of these cases is that 75% of the 13 and 14-year-olds that we document in our report were actually sentenced to life imprisonment without parole under mandatory sentencing laws. That is, the judges in many of these cases didn't necessarily want to impose a sentence of life imprisonment without parole, but had no discretion. They could not consider the child's age. They could not consider the child's background. They couldn't consider the fact that there was an older co-defendant, more culpable. Because of mandatory sentencing laws, many of these kids ended up with these very harsh sentences. And mandatory sentencing, mass incarceration, have conspired to create a very, very dangerous environment for young kids, you know, in poor and minority communities, because they are at such great risk of arrest and prosecution.
Now, in some of the cases, the lawyers and some of these were court-appointed lawyers, of course, because, as you said, these are poor children whose families can afford lawyers. In some of these cases, I understand the lawyers didn't even appeal these life imprisonment cases where appeals were possible?
Yeah, that was very surprising. We were really shocked to find so many of these cases where no one had ever challenged the propriety of sentencing a 13- or 14-year-old to life imprisonment without parole. No appeals were filed. That issue wasn't raised. When we talked to some of the lawyers who had represented some of these kids, they didn't even remember that the client was 13 or 14 at the time of the offense. And it just speaks to the problems of indigent defense in this country. I mean, unfortunately, our criminal justice system is a system that treats you much better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And in a wealth-sensitive system like ours, the ability to access quality legal representation is really difficult if you don't have resources, if you don't have money. And most of these kids could have avoided these kinds of outcomes with better legal aid, and it's just tragic that that is perhaps the greatest explanation of how they ended up in this situation, the inability to get adequate legal help.
My guest is Brian Stevenson, Executive Director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. He's also a professor of law at the New York University School of Law. And you can look at the report that we have been discussing called Cruel and Unusual at their website, eji.org. The report has a lot of photographs of these children. Again, it's eji.org. And Brian, I think if you can emphasize for our listeners just what these kids face in prison. I mean, a 13 or 14-year-old convicted of a crime, facing the rest of his or her life in prison. I mean, that's it. No hope for them. What do they face in prison?
Well, it's really, very disturbing. Many states do not have facilities that are designated for young offenders. If you're certified to stand trial as an adult, you are placed in an adult prison. And so many of these young teens enter adult prisons, and because they have a life without parole sentence, they're placed in the most secure maximum prison. So a lot of these kids are put in prisons with, you know, the most dangerous and hardened offenders in some of the most violent institutions in the country. When you're young, when you are the age and size of some of these kids, you're at much greater risk of physical assault, sexual assault.
And did you find that particularly physical and sexual assault among the cases?
Absolutely. There was a much greater incidence of assault and victimization among this population than what you would find for adult offenders. And that just adds to the trauma, that adds to the difficulty of overcoming a sentence like this. And so that's been another part of the problem facing these young people. One of the really encouraging things though, about some of these kids is that they've been incredibly responsive to intervention because they haven't had many opportunities. When there have been opportunities for kind of people to share in their story and share in their struggle and to try to help them through these problems, we've seen tremendous progress. But, yeah, it's a really difficult plight. The suicide rate and the suicide attempts are quite common in the population. It's been very difficult for some of these folks to, you know, recover from some of the injuries they've sustained. But, you know, one of the things that our program is trying to do is to provide a kind of comprehensive approach to this. We don't want to just provide them legal representation and not be attentive to the real psychic and emotional problems that are associated with this kind of incarceration at these ages.
So your organization, Equal Justice Initiative, is taking on as many of these cases as you can?
We are, and we've now filed on behalf of kids in about 10 states. We've got a couple dozen cases pending. I'm delighted to report, actually, one of the kids in the report just got relief this week. We won a relief with Philip Shaw, who is in Missouri, a couple of days ago, and we're hopeful that he'll get a new trial. He still has to face a new trial. You know, the other thing that's worth noting is that there's a surprising number of these cases where there's a very powerful claim of innocence. I mean, what tends to happen with juvenile crime is that you'll have 2, 3, 4 kids involved in an incident, and assigning culpability is oftentimes very difficult, but we've gotten good evidence in several of these cases that these children were not either involved or certainly were not primarily involved in these offenses. But again, without advocates and without good resources, it's hard for kids this age without strong families and support systems to protect themselves. So the incidence of wrongful conviction is quite high, and we believe that's the case in the Philip Shaw case that we just got some relief on a couple of days ago.
Finally, Brian, tell our listeners about the photographs in your report, Cruel and Unusual.
Yeah, we really feel for this kind of issue, it's important for people to have, you know, some understanding of the humanity of these folks. I mean, we're so quick in this country to believe the worst about everybody, to throw people away, to believe that everyone is just their worst act. And we want people to see the humanity of these clients. And so we do have a lot of images of the clients that we're currently representing, and we were able to get into some of the institutions and take photographs. They're actually older in the photographs than they were at the time of the offense or the time of their conviction. We also got some photographs from an amazing photographer who was in a detention facility with kids in the age group that we're talking about, and some of those photos are in the report as well. You know, there really is this silent crisis that has gone, in my view, unnoticed and undiscussed about the plight of kids who are being institutionalized, incarcerated, and subjected to conditions of confinement that are really brutal, that have, in my opinion, not gotten the attention that they need. And so we're hoping that the report will also be a catalyst to rethink the way we give up on killed children, condemn children, and throw away children, because that's certainly, in our view, not consistent with human rights and you know, equal justice.
Well, Brian Stevenson, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Brian Stevenson is Executive Director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. We've been discussing the report, Cruel and Unusual, and you can download that at eji.org, eji.org. We're now joined on the phone by Kim McGill with the Youth Justice Coalition here in Southern California. YJC is organizing an action this afternoon, calling on elected officials to suspend their research and build community centers instead of prisons to house youth. Welcome to Uprising, Kim.
Hi, how's everything?
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us about what's happening this afternoon and what you're calling on elected officials particularly to do.
Well, we've called together young people, youth organizations, and gang intervention workers this afternoon to talk to the media, the general public, and especially to elected officials to stop the gang banging that's happening between government agencies and start really funding the programs that people have been calling LA to do, not only just for this year, but for the past 30 years.
And what do you mean by the gang banging between government agencies?
Well, there's been a huge amount of money spent on studies over the past year to say again what people already knew, which was that young people need jobs, they need youth centers, and they need gang intervention workers on the street if we're going to have peace in Los Angeles. Similar cities and counties all over the United States have tried these exact same strategies and have much lower violence on their streets. And people have been saying it not just during the past year, but for the past 30 years. And yet the mayor's office, the city council, and the controller's office are all arguing about what plan to follow, about the kind of strategies slowing down the process in terms of putting a huge bureaucracy together to impact the issue. And not surprisingly, the murder rate has increased again. So in the last 2 months, for January and February and the beginning of March, we have a 30% increase in homicides during the same period last year.
So you
and
want
the majority of the victims are young people.
You want gang intervention workers on the streets. What exactly does that mean?
Well, they're primarily people who have been involved in gangs themselves or whose family members have been involved in gangs. They have a license to operate from the neighborhoods that they're in, meaning that they have the trust and the confidence of people on the street that they can really do the work on the streets in those communities. In some cases...
Are you with us still, Kim? And that's Kim McGill. Are you still with us, Kim?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I got that. In some cases, they're talking guns out of the hands of young people. In some cases, when there is a shooting, they're in the community, even if it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, to stop people from retaliating. In some cases, they're building truces between neighborhoods within a particular community or between neighborhoods within regions.
So you're calling on the city to fund these sorts of workers?
Yeah, we really think that the county needs 500 of those workers at the very least to hold peace in the county. That would even be a small investment in comparison to what they've made on the prison and policing side for decades now.
And, of course, you're also calling on jobs and youth centers. Where and exactly and when is this action taking place?
It's this afternoon at 3 o'clock here at the YJC. And the YJC shares our space with other organizations that are addressing the over-incarceration of young people and communities. And it's called Chuco's Justice Center after one of our members who was killed in the streets. It's located at 253 West Martin Luther King Boulevard between Broadway and Broadway Place. And we welcome everybody to come out.
That's Chuco's Justice Center, 253 West Martin Luther King Boulevard in L.A. this afternoon at 3 p.m. Any plans for any elected officials, the mayor, anyone to attend?
Well, we haven't invited them specifically, but we do know that a lot of them got the notice, and the mayor's office is definitely coming out. And the reason that we really wanted to have everybody come was not only to have young people address the public directly, but also to have a strategy session afterwards about how we can push forward these recommendations after today. So if anyone wants to be a part of that conversation, they'll have an opportunity to do that.
And is there a phone number?
Sure. They can contact us here at the center at 323-235-4243. Or if they need to reach us in an emergency in late night hours, they can contact us at 323-327-1259.
And those numbers are 323-235-4253. The emergency after-hours number is 323-327-1259. We'll put that on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Kim McGill, thanks so much for joining us. Best of
Thank
luck this
both.
Afternoon.
Thanks.
Kim McGill is with the Youth Justice Coalition. And if you missed any of this information, links to any reports, you can always go to our website, uprisingradio.org, where we will have them for you.